What does responsibility look like in architecture today? This is what I'm going to discuss with Lina Gottmey, who is a Paris-based architect.
Design Perspectives, the podcast of the German Design Council. Today with host Martin Paoli.
Welcome to this new episode of Design Perspectives, a podcast format of the German Design Council. My name is Martin Paoli. This is a special episode and I'm excited to be joined by one of the most thoughtful voices in architecture today. Lina Gottmey is a Paris-based architect whose work is guided by the idea of arcology of the future, a design philosophy that listens deeply to place, memory and material. Her buildings, from the Stone Garden in Beirut to the Serpentine Pavilion in London, reflect a very careful balance of history, sustainability and innovation. So Lina's approach invites us to think differently about how we build, not just in form, but in purpose. Welcome, Lina.
Thank you. Hi, Martin. How are you?
I'm very well. So I'm really glad to have you, Lina. Thanks for taking the time. You often speak of architecture as an arcology of the future, and I'm really curious to understand kind of what that means and how that shapes your sense of responsibility.
Thank you for your question, Martin. You know, I speak about archaeology of the future. It's mainly a method, actually, of work. It's a way of looking at architecture as an act that is constantly drawing from its environment, looking at being rooted in a place before projecting into the future, before being present in a place itself. So really understanding what resources we are building with, looking at histories of typologies and looking at the impact of what a space can have on its place, on its context. It's a process that I developed by infatuation in the beginning with archaeology itself as a field. I grew up in Beirut looking at the city being built and rebuilt. And every time a new building would emerge, I would see these open archaeologies and look at the history of our civilization, but also look at how archaeologists work by researching the ground, looking at traces, connecting them together, and revealing histories of our past through the connections that they could find from the place. So it's a highly physical process. I was always influenced by that and thought how we could actually learn from this process to bring it into architecture, mainly to ground architecture and to allow it to be physically connected to the place from the resources of the place itself, but also to be able to have an architecture that is responsible, that echoes the presence of history, of past, that acknowledges social relationships that exist in a place and that could have a positive impact in the context in which it emerges.
Yeah, I think the positive impact is pretty spot on, and also, of course, the resource. Kind of, we seem to live in a very resource-constrained world, and in that context, particularly, that approach or that process seems to be more relevant than ever before. No,
we are living in a time where we're shifting our value system, hopefully, and looking more closely at how we build, with what we build, what role can architecture play? Can architecture be more present also in our built environment? Because architects don't build all of our built environment today. We constitute very small percentage of what is built around us. In a time where we have the urgency of climate change, where we're talking about migration, where we're talking about wars, resources become a very important matter. How do we build? What do we build with? And what role can architecture play in that sense? So we're always looking in my practice at using biosourced materials, materials that are available locally, and being conscious of the carbon footprint of every construction.
So you mentioned Beirut already, and of course I was going to ask about kind of that. You grew up there in post-war Beirut. So how did that shape your values as an architect? How can I imagine the little Lina in Beirut?
Yeah, Beirut is such a wonderful city, actually. It's full of contradictions. It's a place of a lot of color, of light, Mediterranean climate, where you have the beauty of the blue sea that renders everything sublime in a way through the presence and intense presence of nature, where you see around you textures from old buildings that are left out or ruined constructions where light comes in and nature organically rises and takes over the built space. So there's a constant encounter with beauty despite all the violence that the city had lived. And that beauty that is present through history, through the nature itself, also teaches you something about how to build. But also it's a like place that talks about diversity of people coming from different backgrounds, beliefs, and trying to cohabit in the same or the same ground in the same city. And that diversity brings a lot of richness, and it allows you also to handle complexity as an inherent part of our living and an inherent part also of architecture. So I grew up in this context in Beirut, but also I used to go to the mountains because my father is originally from a small village in the mountains. So we used to go up and there and spend summers, and such a influential place to be close to nature, close to the mountains, close to those heights. So this kind of constant movement between the cityscape and the mountainscape, and looking at also how do we construct two different places, had influenced definitely the way I perceive and do architecture.
So it seems like you knew from like very early days you would become an architect, or is that...
In reality, I grew up drawing a lot, so I was spending a lot of time in those years where we had some unstable years in Beirut, in Lebanon, but also when escaping to the mountains, I used to draw a lot, spend a lot of time, with my brush, and loved really architecture in a way. I was sensitive to space, sensitive to vernacular techniques of construction. But during my childhood, or at least when I started thinking of what to do, I was rather drawn by medicine and archaeology as fields. But then, I started a bit of biology, and along that also architecture, because I was advised to do architecture by doing a simple test, actually. Like, it turned out architecture is a field that could correspond to me. And this is my starting point. And then I realized that actually I really liked this field of architecture and continued.
That was a very successful test outcome then, if I may say. Imagining you...
That's the first time I talk about it, actually, yeah.
Imagining you with that kind of brush. So did architecture become your way to kind of respond to the context around you and then to the world around you?
It did, because when I was growing in Beirut, I was always wishing I could, bring people together through architecture, that it could be a way to heal the landscape, a way to bring beauty back into the city. So it's a bit part of this desire to mend and to improve our surrounding.
Your buildings feel almost handcrafted. Yeah, you were referring to the materiality and to the textures and to all these fragments. How do materials, what role play materials in your work, and how do they, or are they even reflecting emotional or ethical choices? You mentioned that already in a climate and resource context, but I suppose there are more layers to it, or there's nuance.
I think materials are, from one side, a way to connect us to our surrounding, to remind us that we are part of the surrounding, part of nature. We are a material ourselves, we become earth after life, and we dissolve as part of the ground, part of this environment. So in that sense, when we are encountering spaces with heightened materiality, it encourages us to touch those spaces, to interact with them, to understand what materials are used. And mainly when we are in a place that is made out of materials that are biosourced, that are part of nature, we're really brought into a very peaceful also feeling and connection with our environment. So from that standpoint, that's where I'm interested in materials, really, and what materials we use and how do we connect the users, people, to their built space. On another side, crafting and making spaces is also about bringing on care in the way we make our environment. And the question of care is something very important, because when we do things with care, it's also they are used with care as well. And we are also creating a sense of attachment to the places we make. It's somehow crucial that we build with care, that we care about what we're doing, that we craft in a way to show care to the community that is using any architecture. I think it's also about building knowledge, because when crafting, like for example, in the Tower of Beirut, doing this whole envelope that is crafted by hand is also empowering the artisans, the workers that are part of the making process, or whether it's in the Atelier Hamas where we did all the bricks by hand and built the whole structure with brick. In a way, it empowers the builders to be connected to the construction and to learn about how to make. And the building, in a way, becomes a concentration of knowledge and of brings on the possibility of building knowledge through architecture.
What I kind of got from this is that, I guess, your hypothesis is also that people that then experience the architecture, this has an impact on their experience, the way they kind of perceive those materials and also the traces of the craftsmen and all that. Is that part of it?
Yes, so there's a sense of human approach to it and a humanist approach. And of course, there is also an approach to think about the living in general as well. So at the end, as architects, we build for people, right? We build for the also the living. So how do we connect and create spaces that are able to build symbiosis with the living around us, basically.
Yeah. Can you tell us more about the Stone Garden project? Because that seems to somehow manifest a lot of those principles about the concrete and the memory that is embedded in it and so on.
Well, Stone Garden project is this tower that is a residential tower or like a ground floor that is dedicated to a gallery, which is a platform for exchange about artistic production in the MENA region. And it's a building that is positioned very close to the city center of Beirut. The city center was completely destroyed after the war, and at the same time, it was refurbished very quickly after the war in 1998. And that, in a way, also led to the loss of the memory of what had happened and a sort of gentrification also to the city center. So when building really this tower, the question that I asked is, how does this building first react to questions of memory of the city, because we're very close to that center, but also we are in the midst of Beirut with all what it lived. So can architecture in a way echo memory and echo the city in a more active way rather than being just a memorial of what had happened? At the same time, it's also taking a stance on how to build a tower in a context like Beirut, how to find an identity to towers in these contexts, not again do a glass tower or a tower that would be also the same as a New York tower that would be replicated in that context. So look at the vernacular way of construction, look at the way we can measure the opening in a Mediterranean climate, shape an architecture that echoes the building regulations, but also becomes a sculpted form that is anchored in its site. So the building itself emerges like almost sculpted in a place, and it reacts to the different streets very differently from one side to the other. And then when it came to crafted and to its material, it was about letting it emerge from the ground, allowing it to be anchored in a place like a piece of stone that emerges vertically, or like a piece of ground that is chiseled and where nature can exist. And this is where we started working on this finish and this technique of rendering that is inspired by vernacular ways of also rendering in Beirut, but then giving it thickness, combing it with a metal comb that we drew on the scale of the building, allowing the also workers to be part of the development process of this technique. And that gave way almost like a sculpture that is really feeling that is grounded in earth, where also all the loggias, the windows become inhabited by nature and they frame the outside in a very particular way. So it's a living building. It's a building for the living, and that is itself living as well along the seasons in that Mediterranean climate.
So if the architecture then kind of embodies all those kind of memories and the kind of that particular identity that you're shaping, is it then also becoming a political statement?
Well, I don't know if I'm trying to make statements. I think architecture is really political anyway, because architecture is about a manifestation of different dynamics in physical space. So it responds to economy, it responds to our political scene, it responds to social challenges, it responds to material challenges. So, and that's what's fascinating about our discipline as architects, is that it has to listen to all those different like dynamics and disciplines and somehow bring in a quintessence of all this into a physical form. So it does take a political position, but it doesn't necessarily like act as a statement in itself, or it could be understood as a statement if it wants to be. But what I try to think of when designing is really how architecture can be critical, can have a, you know, critical presence as of allowing itself to open questions and allowing one to wonder, to question, and to open the imaginary rather than close and give us a definite answer to things.
And critical towards whom?
It's not the sense of being critical to someone. A critical thinking is one that allows you to be able to question things. It's not about criticism. It's a critical thinking. It's about being able to be analytical in the way you produce spaces or you produce something. And being analytical, being in an open thinking manner, allows somehow architecture not to be definite in closed space. For example, I would imagine like some of the spaces that we produced are spaces that allow for functions to be appropriated openly, where people can use them in a very different way. Architecture for me and Stone Garden is also a building that could be interpreted by different people in various ways as well, that talk about memory. They talk also about different way of living inside. It doesn't dictate one way of understanding, but includes in it this diversity of thinking and allows questioning.
Speaking of questioning, you mentioned, you touched on aspects like the climate imperative and resources and energy. You mentioned that this is not a glass building, but a stone building. I guess that's also, there's also a reason behind it. Your Hermès workshop is energy positive. What's your take on what does truly responsible and sustainable architecture look like today? Because that agenda seems to manifest itself differently over the past decades. But is there a new era ahead of us?
I think like the more we move forward, the question is how do we allow buildings to have positive impacts? Like when we are building, to have a positive architecture, like that is worthwhile existing in a way for me. There's a lot of effort done in construction and in architecture. So construction has to be worthwhile being there. Sometimes you're able to push things to perform in all of its senses, like in a way that an architecture can be beautiful, can have a positive aesthetic impact, but also that has a virtuous impact in terms of its carbon footprint and energy impact on a context in terms of its use. And I think the current technologies and the more we move forward, we have more tools also to assess the consumption of construction and what materials we use, what are their carbon footprint, etc. And that's great tools actually to allow us really to be more close to our buildings, and also assess them as living organisms that are not about just forms and shells, but they're made of material, they're made of all what allows them to work in terms of their mechanical systems. And for us as architects to dig into that further and to know further about that, to be able to allow a building to be sustainable. And this is what we pushed in this manufacturing building, because generally manufacturing structures are ones that consume a lot of energy. You know, you need a lot of energy to work with the machines that are used to manufacture whatever the product is. And here we wanted to understand how we can push to have a very ecological building, although it's a manufacturing construction. And it took us different steps. From one step is to think of how to build in a bioclimatic way. And when I'm saying bioclimatic, is how it can respond to the climate around, takes advantage of the sun or the wind to be able to be the best positions also on the site. And in a way, the building needs less energy to take less energy to be able to be used. So it needs less climatization, less heating. So that's an important step. And then afterwards is looking at what materials we use, how do we bring materials from close by so they have least carbon footprint, how do we build with the landscape by not removing the earth of the site, using it for the landscape itself, or what energies we give, for example, whether we use geothermal energies, etc. So it's really a complex a set of givens and of elements that are brought together to allow a building to be ambitious and low carbon.
Yeah, it has become incredibly complex. That's what also seems to be like a red line from the conversations also with other architects. Now, there's no silver bullet and there's no one fits all. It's a constant navigation of things that interrelate with each other. But in your particular case, that approach of permanence in architecture, which might be like every architect potentially wants to create permanence.
Not sure. Yeah.
But many, at least, many that I kind of met so far. And of course, then there's always that tension in that ecological context. Yeah? Do we need to create buildings that last forever, even if we don't know? Can they adapt to changing needs and whatnot? Can you give us a bit of a flavor as to how you navigate those tensions?
I mean, as an architect, I'm really not obsessed with questions of permanence. I don't think building something is not about building things forever. In the reverse, I believe that things are in constant state of becoming or transformation, like the material is constantly transforming. Time is weathering things, you know, so just believing in that also brings you a much modest and much more humility in a way that in regards to architecture and what we build. And I think the question of time is related also to sustainability. Sometimes we may find ourselves that it's much more sustainable to build things in a temporal way, for example, with materials that can be dismantled in a way that we can reuse all the materials of a building, like, for example, what we did for the Osaka Pavilion in Japan, where all the pavilion is built with around 4 meters length wood elements that are unengineered, that where we can disassemble everything and re-put it in the market. And other times you find that it's more important that things are built in a more robust way, that the building doesn't need to be dismantled or, let's say, completely wasted after 50 years. So it's really about how do you measure, how do you correspond to the best situation of each building, and allow the question of time to be on your side to build a positive impact of the architecture in question.
Your Serpentine Pavilion, I mean, of course, that was a building that was not designed to be permanent, but what I understood is it was less about the permanence, but it was more kind of supposed to become a space for exchange, invite communities. Can space encourage that connection where we have communities that are increasingly fragmented and some societies and communities under pressure. Can you tell us a bit about the intention behind that particular approach?
Of course, thankfully, space can have an impact on bringing people together, and the configuration of spaces like the Serpentine Pavilion is this kind of flower-like shape that has petals and it is more circular. And the whole idea was to bring people in one place in a sense of centrality, bring in this table where people could gather around, where conferences become more circular, and there is a sense of dialogue that emerges when conferences are done in a circular manner. But also there were events around the table where we share one meal, or people just sitting there to take a cup of coffee and somehow feeling that they are sharing the same space, which is that both of the pavilion and the space of the building itself, you know, the structure itself. And I think sometimes we could underestimate how much as architects we have the tools to do that, because we, in the way we configure spaces, are able to create connections, to foster relationships, or to sometimes allow situations to happen that are not necessarily what we've been thinking about in the design process. I'm always very keen about the social aspect of the spaces that we create in my practice, and how could they be delightful spaces where people enjoy to be there, and they are spaces that connect them, that they have a bit of a theatrical as well approach to them.
And do you find it easy to kind of design architecture that responds culturally? You're operating in various different contexts, obviously, and I personally could imagine it's difficult kind of to get a feeling as to kind of how those local communities and people function. How do you navigate that?
I think with a lot of openness and the desire to listen, actually, and to learn from other cultures, and with the curiosity to really understand those cultures. I think the fact, again, of having grown up in Beirut with this diversity, it gave me the passion of really wanting to understand better our world and us humans in different conditions and different cultures. And when working in any project, this research-driven approach with the notion of the archaeology of the place is about really understanding that culture and really communicating with the people and having the patience and the sense of being there, you know, being with the people, and in a way you become the other, you know, you allow yourself to take part of this culture and to allow it to influence you, to polonize you as well. And that's wonderful, because we become more colorful as beings, but also architecture becomes more colorful as well. It becomes more like taking the specificities of the places where we're intervening. Like, for example, the Osaka Pavilion, it's really, it does echo in a way the Japanese culture with the use of wood, with the use of this fabric that has a sense of washi. So there are lots of subtleties as well that respect the culture there, that allows also Bahrain to be in communication with the local culture that in which we are implemented. And I think the sense of respect and the sense of dignity that we bring to architecture is essential, because it shows that we care. And that's, for me, again, something that is central to architecture.
I suppose when communities also relate differently to the architecture, if it kind of follows a local logic and culture, it makes it easier, I guess, to approach it. I'm really keen to take a look with you into the future and into the tomorrow. I know you're teaching a lot, so you're kind of working with the next generation of architects, and I'm really kind of curious to understand how they think about the future. I mean, are they stressed, or do they kind of feel a certain or a different urgency than we might have felt being at the university?
I think I hear a lot of different stands on the future with the students. Some of them, they're wondering, you know, about all the challenges that we're facing, climate change, and sometimes lost on how we you know, how to bring on optimism and the way to build. And I always encourage them to be optimistic, because at least our discipline, which is that of architecture, is one that carries optimism, that carries positivity in it. We have to be proud of that and continue to perform that through what we make. And I think also there are questions that are more, you know, technical. Like last week I was in Melbourne and I was speaking with two students and just understanding what they're worried about. And they tell me, like, for example, today when we are designing, we're constantly working with the computer, you know, programs. So our design process is really dictated by the programs that we work on. We don't need any more books. We don't work with the libraries. So it's a completely different process, and history is less taught in schools. And it's somehow a challenge, because then it voids out, you know, the essence and the substance of architecture, and also the understanding of scale, the possibility of projecting human beings, but also humanities in architecture. And then it was an interesting discussion to see what is the interest of building knowledge to make architecture, and why is it important to still, while we work with computers, we still have to also explore other mediums and bring on the book or bring on the model or the sketch along with the computer model work. So the questions are diverse, and every, I think, decade has its own questions. And what's fascinating about our discipline is that it keeps transforming. And of course, now with AI, also it will take another, again, leap. But still, the architect is always a thinker, is always a maker, and will always find his or her place in society as an essential thinker of the way we inhabit our world.
What advice, I mean, if you're giving it advice, probably it's the wrong word, but those students must also face a lot of uncertainty and complexity. You know, there's that VUCA world being volatile and uncertain.
But
and
I think we should stop flattening the world. We should stop looking at simplicity. The human condition and life is complex. It has been complex since the start. And we have to learn to keep assessing complexity and working with complexity and allowing that complexity to be the you know, the colorful part of what we do. And the more complex, the challenging, the more, you know, substance we have in architecture, the more it becomes relevant. Sometimes I feel like we are living in a world where things become more and more binary. You either like or dislike, either, you know, understand or don't understand. And unfortunately, that's very reductive. I think complexity is amazing. So let's embrace it and let's work with that complexity to make useful and relevant architecture.
No, I love that. It's about embracing it rather than being scared. No, because yes, and maybe that's also the role of architects, to really kind of embrace it, understand it, disaggregate the problem and somehow assemble it in a new way and kind of create a response to that complexity. We are almost at the end, unfortunately, but last question, Lina, who inspires you?
Everything inspires me. The world inspires me. Recently, I'm reading a book about time, which is by Carlo Rovelli, and he's a physicist, and it's really amazing. It talks about the notion of time and quantum physics, and that's already now is my current inspiration, is how do we relate to time, and maybe time does not exist, actually, and it's just a series of events that are interconnected. It's a transformation of also the way we look at architecture.
That's fantastic. I wish time would not exist, because then we could continue this conversation for longer. So thanks a lot, Lina, for taking us on this journey. That was really fascinating.
Thank you, Martin. Thank you.
What really stayed with me from my conversation with Lina is how her early days in Beirut, with its colors, light, and cultural richness, continue to shape her sense of architecture as a way of bringing people together. I was struck how she spoke about materials and craftsmanship as a way to connect us more deeply with nature and with each other. And perhaps the most inspiring was her reminder that embracing complexity rather than fearing it opens up new ways of thinking and teaching. So we would love if you subscribe to Design Perspectives. If you have questions, comments or feedback, feel free to email us at podcast@gdc.de.
The Design Perspectives podcast is a production of the German Design Council.